Welcome back to Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. So we just heard in Laura Ziegler's piece, Kansas's new rules for food stamp recipients require them to work if they are able-bodied and have no dependents. They're actually federal requirements that were in effect until 2009, but were waived across the country when the recession hit. Kansas is one of a handful of states that are voluntarily reinstating those rules. But if Congress makes major cuts to the SNAP program, Kansas's culling of the food stamp rules could be a preview of what's to come for the rest of the country. Do you think people should be required to work to receive food stamps? Kansas City, call us with your thoughts and questions at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Now, to help us understand the potential impact of cutting people from food stamps, we have with us today Ellen Feldhausen of Harvesters, the Community Food Network in Kansas City. Welcome.
Good morning.
And Rachel Sheffield, the policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also James Ziliak, economics professor at the University of Kentucky and director for the Center of Poverty Research. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Let's start with you, Professor James Ziliak. Can you explain why food stamps have historically been a part of the Farm Bill? We just heard Jeremy Bernfeld talking about that a little bit, about that coalition of urban and rural legislators.
Yeah, that's certainly the origins of it. I mean, the initial food stamp program was more of a commodity distribution program starting in the 1930s and carried on through World War II. And then when President Kennedy was elected in 1960, in response to his exposure to widespread poverty, especially in the state of West Virginia, he started a movement to establish a food stamp program. And I think there, you know, in part to try to get support in the Senate, he included it or proposed that, you know, it be included as part of the Ag Department because the original authoring legislation of the bill makes very explicit that it's not only to address hunger and malnutrition in the United States, but also to strengthen the nation's agricultural economy. So it's very, very much part of the initial legislation.
Just moving ahead in time, how long has there been this work requirement on SNAP that was waived in 2009?
1996. It was part of the 1996 welfare reform bill that added this new dimension that if you are an able-bodied adult without a dependent between the ages of 18 and 50, that you could qualify for food stamps only 3 months out of every 36-month period unless you're working at least 20 hours per week or engage in other type of activity at a level commensurate with working like 20 hours per week or more. And so, in effect, if you are just a part-time worker working, you know, less than 20 hours a week without dependents and without a documented disability, then you can only get food stamps a few months out of every few years.
And what happened when that requirement was instituted?
Well, what you would see is there was an increase in the share of the case that was comprised of adults with children in the household, as well as a slight uptick in the fraction of the caseload that were seniors. It's also the case, you know, when that legislation went into place, that the economy was very strong, right? So we had a very strong economy from 96 to 2000. And so some of these individuals may have been able to find work quite readily at that time. It's important to know, though, that states were given the option to apply for a waiver since 1996 from that provision if they had very high rates of unemployment in their local area, rates that exceeded the national rate and were also persistently high for some documented period of time. And so states did periodically, you know, request waivers from USDA from that rule, especially during the 2001 recession.
And what happened when it was waived in 2009 during that recession? I understand that food stamp usage skyrocketed.
Yeah, food stamp usage actually has skyrocketed. It started its upward trend around 2001 during the recession, and it's increased about 170% since 2000, and it continued to increase and accelerated after the Great Recession. And so because jobs were scarce for people of all walks of life, including those able-bodied adults without dependents, their numbers on the caseload increased commensurate as well.
And I want to bring in our other guest, Rachel Sheffield of the Heritage Foundation. How do you see what happened with food stamps when the recession hit, that most recent recession, 2009?
Well, we certainly saw an increase in participation, and that can certainly be attributed to the recession in part. However, we have seen policy changes put into place over the years that have made it easier for people to get onto the food stamp rolls. So there's two different factors working here in this increase that we've seen in
what
over the years.
What policy changes are those?
Different loopholes, for example, something known as broad-based categorical eligibility that has allowed states to overlook asset tests, for example, and thereby increase the rolls, make it expand eligibility to a broader pool of people.
What do you mean by overlook asset tests?
So, for example, individuals that are applying for food stamps states are required to look at what type of assets they have, money in the bank, for example.
I see.
And this policy has allowed states to, in many cases, overlook that.
And what happens when, from your perspective, what happens when you require people to work to receive food stamps, at least those without kids?
Well, what we've seen in the past with a work requirement, so, for example, back in 1996, when welfare reform was put into place with the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, we saw welfare rolls decrease significantly. We also saw employment rates among low-income individuals increase and child poverty decline. Now, certainly that was a different economic time. However, those changes can partly be attributed to the welfare reform. So I think when we're requiring work, we see individuals move towards self-sufficiency, which really should be the goal of welfare.
And James Siliak, what does your research show on that? Can you separate sort of the changes in the economy from the changes in the requirements?
Yeah, you can, and I have, in fact. So my, estimates show that from 2000 through 2011, which is the last year data I had, about 50% of the increase was due to the weak economy, and about 28% was due to this expanded policies, both broad-based categorical eligibility and a couple other changes, the vehicle asset tests, that did allow individuals to join the rolls. So, the policy changes have mattered. But it's important to keep in mind why those policy changes came about, and that is prior to the 96 welfare reform, about 70% of those individuals who are eligible for the food stamp program actually signed up to receive benefits. And that fell to about 50% by 2000. So one in two people who are eligible failed to sign up for the benefits. And so policymakers in Washington were somewhat alarmed at this kind of change, turn of events in terms of what we call the take-up rate. And so that kind of sowed the seeds for reforms, which include the introduction of the broad-based categorical eligibility, changes to the vehicle asset test, introducing things like call centers, allowing children of legal immigrants in general to become re-eligible for the food stamp program, and so on and so forth. So there was a number of policies that the USDA allowed states to experiment with to try to expand outreach.
And so
while
more people.
That's right, and it succeeded, and so now the take-up rate today is back up just over 70%, which is the level it was before the 96 welfare reform.
That's 70% of people who are eligible that are actually using them? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right, and so the importantly, while they have expanded the access, each year they do a random quality control survey of food stamp recipients, and they construct what's called an error rate, which is the percentage of benefits that are either overissued or underissued. And so state by state, they construct these error rates. And nationally, that rate is just below 4%, which is the lowest it's ever been in the program's history. So while they are expanding access, it seems to be running fairly efficiently.
You're listening to Casey Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're talking about the 20,000 people cut from the SNAP program in Kansas and potential cuts to the program elsewhere. Have you or anyone you know relied on the SNAP program or food stamps? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888 or tweet us at Casey Currents. We're going to take a couple phone calls in a minute, but first I want to ask Ellen Feldhausen, who's here from Harvesters. I wonder about here locally. What did you see in terms of hunger and food stamp usage when the recession hit in 2009, late 2000s?
Well, Harvesters is the regional Feeding America food bank. We serve 26 counties, including the Kansas City metropolitan area. And we are, through our network of 620 nonprofit agencies, feeding more people than we've ever fed in our 35-year history. Last fiscal year, which ended in June, we distributed 44.7 million pounds of food. And since FY 2008, our distributions have increased 73% as a result of the recession and as the result of many working people needing food. 40% of the households that we serve have at least one person in them working. We know anecdotally many of those households have people holding two or more jobs to try to make ends meet. So we know that we're serving a lot of low-income working families, as well as almost half of the people we serve are children and seniors.
And do you know if some of the people you serve also receive food stamps but still need that extra help?
About 50% of the people we serve receive food stamps.
Hmm. I want to take a caller here. Here in KCK, Michelle. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
What's your comment or question?
My comment and concern is for the homeless people of Kansas. Those folks who are homeless face additional barriers to finding a job, and training programs aren't free. So I expect that a lot of those folks will lose their eligibility for the SNAP program because they can't find a part-time job or afford the training. And this is very concerning for me because homeless folks face enough challenges as it is and would obviously prefer not to starve.
And Rachel Sheffield of the Heritage Foundation, what are your thoughts about homeless people and them, their ability to enter the job market?
Yeah, well, I guess just speaking to specifically to the homeless population, I can't speak specifically to that population, but what I would say is that when we look at food stamps and when we're talking about work requirements, you know, I think it's important that, you know, to make the point that, yes, we want this program to work so that those who do need assistance are able to get it, but we also want it to work in a way that it's promoting self-sufficiency for the individual, you know, whether that is work or doing job training or doing job search. And just, you know, as far as the cost of job training, I mean, states are the ones providing the job training. So I don't think it's so much a matter of the individual not being able to afford it. You know, certainly we know the homeless population does face significant barriers, but ultimately this program should aim to promote self-sufficiency while helping those in need.
And Ellen, I don't know if you have a sense locally here what's available in terms of job training, but either you or James Ziliak, I wonder if you can come and talk about what is available for people in terms of job training.
I can't speak to what the government job training programs are, but they're something that I've just learned in the last couple of weeks. We provide food to nonprofit agencies. Many of these nonprofit agencies provide other services, including helping people prepare to go out and interview for a job, providing them with, you don't go from homeless to a job in one swift step. Sometimes it requires help to get there. And what I've learned from some of our nonprofit partners is many of them are cutting back on these other services in order to feed people. And so some of that support from the nonprofit community is not going to be there because so many of the agencies are simply focusing on providing food to people.
Jim Siliak, what is that relationship between unemployment? I mean, Kansas, that is instituting these new requirements, does have a very low unemployment rate nationally, but those are kind of known to be low-wage jobs. Kansas tends to be known as a low-wage state. So what is the relationship between employment and food stamp usage?
Well, in general, the trend has been upward. In fact, an increasing share of the caseload nationwide is full-year, full-time workers, and also full-year, part-time workers. And so what you're seeing actually, you know, looking at over the last three decades is this upward trend of the caseload that is increasingly more likely to be employed. Another thing, if you look at the data, they're also increasingly more likely to be educated with some college, okay, so to be high school graduates and have some post-secondary education, and increasingly living in households that have incomes, you know, just above the federal poverty line. And so, in effect, the SNAP program has kind of evolved into a work support for educated, near-poor working households. Now, it still is serving a population that is not expected to work. You know, roughly two-thirds of the food stamp caseload are children or disabled or seniors. And so we don't, at this point in time, have an expectation of work amongst those populations. Amongst the adults who are of working age population and not disabled, the likelihood of their actually being a part of the labor force has increased over time. And one of the challenges that's facing workers in general, especially low-skilled workers, is the shortage of full-time work and the rise in part-time work. So, the issue that confronts policy is that, you know, somebody might be able to consistently hold a job that's of 15 or so hours a week because that's what they get, and yet technically they wouldn't be eligible for the food stamp benefit under that rule because they don't meet that 20-hour threshold. And so, you know, firms are more inclined in recent years, and most job creation since the Great Recession has been in the form of part-time work, and so it's difficult for individuals actually find the full-time jobs, especially those with fewer skills.
I want to bring in Aaron from Topeka. If you want to join the conversation, call 816-235-2888. That's our number. But hi, Aaron.
My comment is about those who have emotional difficulties like social anxiety disorder who are unable to work extended hours and they're not diagnosed or on Social Security disability, but that food stamp system is basically their only lifeline. And if that's taken away, that'll create a massive hardship for those who are undiagnosed mentally ill.
Jim Siliak, do you have a sense of how many people that fall into that category might be undiagnosed, but having trouble seeking work because of an undiagnosed mental illness will then have a hard time getting a job? And
well, I don't have hard numbers on that. To give you some sense of potential for that population, roughly about 50 to 60% of people who apply for disability insurance are denied. And then of those who appeal that decision, roughly about half end up ultimately receiving the disability. So at least, you know, roughly around a third of people who actually apply for disability are denied. And so amongst that population, they may actually face a barrier or perhaps multiple barriers to employment, and yet they're unable to demonstrate a significant enough need to qualify for disability insurance. And so technically, they could be negatively affected by this policy.
Now, we have a caller in on the plaza. Hi, Al.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a great discussion. I was thinking it was a little on the bureaucratic side, but I just wanted to ask about the human element here a little bit. I think we're getting in that direction. One is I heard recently that the highest percentage level of poverty in the region is actually Johnson County. Now, I know that contradicts the myth of Johnson County, and I was wondering if anybody on the panel
has
any
data.
Statistics about that.
And I think what I have read recently is that the level of poverty is really growing in Johnson County and maybe the greatest growth, but I don't have that data. But you were wondering how you actually qualify for food stamps, too?
Now, that was, the other question was, during the downturn in the economy four years ago, I swear, in 20 million years, I never would have thought I would even consider applying for food stamps. But I did. And it was a very interesting experience because I was in my 60s, unemployable at the moment, and I had savings, but the practical daily living issues were very, very scary at the time. So I applied, and of course I didn't qualify. I had money in the bank, and I had other sources of income that become visible when you apply for food stamps. So I didn't qualify, but here I was in a very strange kind of catch-22 situation. And I just don't know that we understand what it is when people really have a moment of need. And with this idea of providing food to people is a very important thing. If our underclasses are deprived of any more opportunities for growth, we're going to have serious, serious social issues in our culture.
And
we have to know that everyone is fed. And I'm just wondering, how does the food stamp program plan to adjust to the new
economy. You know, we're going to have to bring this to a close because we're bringing this segment to a close, but I really appreciate your comment here and you're sharing your experiences. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us here, too. Ellen Feldhausen of Harvesters, the Community Food Network in Kansas City, thanks so much. James Ziliak, economics professor at the University of Kentucky, thank you. And Rachel Sheffield, policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation, thank you for your time. Coming up after the break, we ask, what is that? And take a closer look at an unusual-looking house tucked among the split levels and ranches in Casey's Red Bridge neighborhood. This is Casey Currents.